My name is Bob Darrell, and I am certainly alcoholic. By the grace of a very loving God who is crazy about me and has no taste, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are outlined in the big book, good sponsorship, commitments at my home group, and bushels of newcomers. I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering substances since Halloween 1978, and for that I will always owe you my life. I'm delighted to be here. I want to thank Joe and Dave for inviting me here and picking me up at the airport, and got to ride from the St. Louis airport with a Cardinals fan and a Cub fan in the car. And I got to see that AA does work. And I've had a great time. You've made me feel very welcome. I want to welcome the new people, especially the two guys that got the book, the two newest guys. I'm really glad you're here. Next week, if you're lucky enough to have a home group, you're going to go to it, and they're not going to give you a standing ovation, and you're going to realize that they don't treat you nearly as well as those people at that conference. But and it's kind of downhill from there. You got your standing ovation. It's just you're going to end up with another member of AA. But that's a good deal for people like us. I'm here, I believe, to talk to two people. I don't know who you are, but I know you're here. You're always here. The first person I'm here to talk to is that man or woman who, for some reason, you don't understand that no matter how hard you try, you keep going back to drinking. And maybe you've been coming in and out of these rooms for a number of years. I'm here for you because you are me. I was 7.5 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a matter of fact, the worst, most horrific years of my life came in the time after I came to my first AA meeting. Because as I was in and out of these rooms and the disease progressed, and I know exactly what it's like to sit right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and feel like I'm dying. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And I'm trying everything in me not to drink. But I couldn't do it. And the other person I'm here to talk to, and you're here somewhere, you always are, is the man or woman who's leaving AA. And you don't even know you're leaving. And maybe you're leaving one compromised action or commitment at a time, or more likely one judgment at a time. You don't even know you're leaving. You just know that the people in AA are just all of a sudden aren't really up to your standards like you thought they were at one time. And you're starting to really notice what's wrong with them. And that's how I'm here to talk to you, because you're me also. I almost left AA a couple times. I've been fortunate enough to have survived myself here. Because I don't know about you, but if you're an alcoholic of my type, my alcoholism doesn't want me to get better. It always will incline me out of here. It will always incline me back into self-will and judgment and the ways I play God in my head by picking people apart and cause, you know, all that stuff. The same if I think we're all pretty much alike. I suspect, even though I have no evidence, that I might have been born with the disease of alcoholism. And I don't know, I don't have evidence of that except to tell you that there was something that wasn't quite right about me before I ever picked up a drink. And I think I was like a freeze-dried alcoholic waiting for alcohol. And I look back over my childhood, and the only thing I remember with any clarity is me. I remember all about me. I can't tell you how much about my mother and father or sister unless it had to do with me. I was the center of the universe back then. And everything, and as if everything had to do with me. And nobody made me that way. I didn't come from an alcoholic home. I came from a home with a lot of love. My parents adored me. They'd have done anything to help me. They'd have done anything for me. My sister, if you were to ask her about the home we grew up in, she could tell you all about the love there. She could feel it. But I was so internally focused and self-involved, even as a child, that I knew intellectually that my parents loved me, but I couldn't feel it. I was that disconnected and disassociated because I didn't really live out here in this world. I lived up here in this one. And that's what self-centered people do. We don't live, we're not centered out here in this world. We're centered up here in this one. And I didn't know that there was anything wrong with me. Dr. Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, says that to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one, so I just adjust to being a little weird. I just adjust to a feeling like I don't quite feel like other people look. I just seem to adjust to an awkwardness socially around people that other people don't seem to have. And I had an event that happened to me when I was about 12 years old, almost 13, where the disease of alcoholism within me was touched by alcohol for the first time. An event that would, I didn't know it at the time, but would change the course of my life. And I'll just, to sum it up, what happened to me is when I started drinking that whiskey with those older kids that I wanted their approval, is basically after the burning stopped, it made me feel so good that the way I would be without that effect from that moment on would never be enough again for me. And I started to live for it. And it seemed like partying and getting lit up moved right into the center of my life. And it seemed like from then on I just kind of existed between opportunities to get lit up. And there was a tremendous magic about it in the early days. And for a lot of years, I probably, my first 8 years of drinking was, six to eight anyway, was phenomenal. I mean, there was a magic about it. A guy like me who doesn't really fit very good, who's has mild, low-level depressions all the time, and my emotions seem to eat my lunch, and I'm overly sensitive, and I live up in my head, and I can't connect with people. I could walk into a party or a bar, and after three or four drinks, I'd come out and play. Seven or eight drinks, and man, I just loved everybody. Remember that feeling? That, I love you, man, right? Oh, yeah. I'd be with that gang of guys I hang around with. Man, there were times I'd feel so a part of and connected to them and almost bring tears to my eyes. Just, oh, my guys. And then I'd sober up and I'd be back to being me again. Never liked that much. Alcohol allowed me to shoot pool better than I could ever shoot pool. Allowed me to dance. I can't dance. You get me about half lit up, man, I can dance. Allowed me to be funny. I'm not funny, really. But I get about half lit up. I could be funny. I could be deep. Remember 3 o'clock in the morning, deep, cracking the secrets of the universe? Get to that place where... Oh, I can see the big picture now. Yeah. Oh, this is what Buddha saw. Yeah. Right? This is amazing. I tell you, if it wasn't for alcohol, I'd probably be celibate to this day. Well, I'm too insecure. I'm too shy. Shy is a nice word for self-obsessed. I'm just too locked up in me. I can't connect with people. I remember in junior high school going to a dance, and I went there kind of on a mission. There was a girl in my class I had a crush on, and some guy had showed me a couple dance steps, and it was a little awkward, but I want to go and dance with this girl because I really had this crush on her, and I'm standing against the wall in the gymnasium trying to get up enough courage, and she's out there on the dance floor dancing with her girlfriend. I'm psyching myself up to go ask her, and I'm just struggling, man. I said, okay, I'm going to ask her. And I said, not this song, next song, next song, next song, next song coming. Next song. And I did that for about a half hour. Finally psyched myself up, just made myself walk over to her. She said no. And I got to walk back across that 9-mile gymnasium, and everybody's looking at me. And it feels like everybody, every time I meet eye contact with somebody, it's like they're I can hear what they're thinking. It's like they're going, oh, you poor, pathetic loser, you. And I go back over to my wall, and I stand there, and I'm spinning in my head. Every time somebody looks in my direction, I just, till I can't take it, bolted out of there. I want you to know I'd have never, ever risked that again. Except later on that year, I was at a dance under the power of 151 rum and coke. And I was smooth. And I had that confidence, and I just... and women, girls were dancing with me, and I was just, I was a part of, man. I just had that magic going on, that magic. And if a girl said no, boy, is she missing it too. Now that's power. That's power to change my experience on this planet. Do you know that non-alcoholics don't get that? They just get drunk. So it's no wonder that after throwing up and maybe one DUI, they just bail out. They can't hang, man. They can't hang. If they got out alcohol, when I'd found out alcohol one time, they'd have hung. They'd have hung in there, hoping to get it back. You know, guys like me, we hang in there years beyond the point where the magic's there, hoping to get it back. That's an amazing effect. I think alcohol really, in those days, in the days when the hook was set, I think alcohol was the most effective and immediate treatment for the real secret disease of alcoholism, the thing that ate my lunch. But it's a progressive disease, and which that, if you don't know what that means, it means as the years go on, the effect and the magic gets more and more elusive and the problems increase. And I'm 15 years old, almost 16, and I'm standing before a juvenile court judge for the third time. And I'm standing before this judge because there's something is going on with me and I don't understand it. But I'm in trouble a lot. And what it is, and I can't connect the dots, is that every time I go out to party with my friends, I can't shut her down when I should. I always go a little too far. I'm always the guy that's getting whacked. I'm always the guy that comes up with the bizarre ideas that seem like a good idea at the time. I'm the guy that has alcoholism. I have that physical allergy to alcohol that Dr. Silkworth talks about in the book. And every time I take a drink of alcohol, something happens to me that I never understood for a lot of years. And I think you can best see it sometimes out of contrast. And my sister is not an alcoholic. And I've watched my sister drink on a lot of occasions. I mean, I've watched my sister drink like a cat will watch a guy eat a tuna fish sandwich. I mean, I even look in her eyes waiting for the effect. I want to see it happen, you know. And my sister, who's not alcoholic, the weirdest thing happens to her. About one or two drinks or drink and a half into the deal, as she's starting to feel the effect in her wiring, which is not alcoholic, it's normal, healthy wiring, it goes, whoa. And she shuts her right down. She gets a feeling like she's losing control. The idea of getting drunk is just, I'm alcoholic. As I drink alcohol and the effect starts to hit me and that glow starts to hit me and my wiring lights up and goes, oh, yeah, come on. And I can't get enough. And I've always been that way. I've had that phenomenon of craving, I think, since the very first time I ever drank. I don't think I've ever had a social drink in my life. I have never once had the experience that non-alcoholics have all the time. The Al-Anons in here have probably had this experience of going to a bar with some friends, and you're going for the purpose of, it's a little more than social drinking, you're going for the purpose of getting lit up and socialized with some people. I have never once sat at a party or a bar, been drinking for about an hour, and had the bartender come over and say, Bob, would you like another drink? I have never once sat there and thought honestly to myself, no, this is just right. Not once. Now, I may shut her down if the heat's on, and I'm with my boss or something, but I never felt like it, right? Because a drink of alcohol always makes me feel like I'd like to have another drink of alcohol. And do you know that reaction to the feeling of alcohol only occurs in chronic alcoholics? It never occurs in non-alcoholics. And that's one of the two pieces in the puzzle why a guy like me will burn his life to the ground. Not just once or twice. I mean, anybody can do that by mistake once. I do it over and over and over and over again. But why? Because I'll get into that a little later. I got alcoholism. It's a hideous disease. It's the only disease I know of. If you've got it, it uses your own mind against you, which is not good. So I'm standing before this juvenile court judge because I keep whacking myself when I drink whiskey. And I love whiskey, but I'm in a lot of trouble. And my parents at the end of their rope keeping me from getting locked up. And I got sent someplace to live for a while. And I'm not there very long. And I'm talking to this kid that's a little bit older than me. He's about 17 and a half. And he's one of the hip kids, this joint. And I'm telling him about what's happened to me, the trouble I'm in. And he's listening. And then he says, well, so you like to party, do you? And I said, yes, I do. He said, but you drink that liquor. That'll make you stupid. I said, oh, man, I don't know. I like that liquor. I just like that. He says, listen, what if I told you that I could give you something that'd make you feel maybe as good as that? They can't smell it on your breath. You will not slur your words or stagger. They won't even know you're high, and you can keep a whole week's supply in your shirt pocket. What would you say to that? Sign me up. And he introduced me to drugs. But I'll tell you, I'm a real alcoholic. Alcoholics should not do drugs. We are pigs. It was bad. Because I do drugs alcoholically. I mean, everything I pick up, I just take it to the wall. I can't get enough. I got that deal. I got this vacancy inside of me that I can't fill. And I'm thirsting for this stuff and the effect. And I can't get it from the drugs like I got it from the alcohol, and I can't get enough. And I, no time at all, I'm doing speed. I'm not doing it very long. And the speed freaks of a dozen, 10 years are telling me to cool it. I mean, I'm just whacked. In no time at all, I've turned myself into some kind of paranoid schizophrenic. I become the guy that if you leave me alone in your car to go get a cigarette, by the time you come out, I've dismantled your radio looking for microphones from the FBI. I mean, you know, I'm nuts. I can't get to the point I couldn't even put two sentences together. I'm spinning in my head so much. A guy came along and said, here, try some of this. And God, when the throwing up stopped, I could think straight. It was, oh, yeah. And my head stopped spinning, and he introduced me to heroin. But God, I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics shouldn't do drugs. And oh, man, I took that to the wall, and doctors and prescription, and full circle back to alcohol, what I started with. And I think I did drugs for the same reason Dr. Bob did drugs. Dr. Bob actually did, in sheer occasion and tonnage, did more drugs than alcohol. He did high-powered sedatives, according to his story, every day of his life for 17 years. He did them for the same reason I did them, because every time I drank, the phenomenon of craving, the alcoholism was so strong within me, I couldn't help but whack myself. And so the drugs bought me some periods of abstinence. One of the great things that was mysterious to me, and I'd come to these treatment centers, and I started going to treatment before I was old enough to take a legal drink. And I'm in an institution, people are starting to tell me about alcoholism, and I don't think I'm an alcoholic. Because I can quit drinking. You keep me properly medicated, I can quit for a while. But what I can't do is I can't stand alone in this world, because my spirit seems to get sick when I stop drinking. And I'm the guy that Dr. Silkworth talks about. He says, guys like me, when we quit drinking, we're restless, irritable, discontent. I'm the guy it talks about on page 52. I suffer from misery and depression. I have a sense of uselessness. I'm full of fear. I'm unhappy. I can't connect with people. I get these low-level depressions. I just don't do very well. So what I do is I get sober and I pretend. But eventually it don't work. And I eventually just yearn for the effect. The great psychiatrist, Carl Jung, in a letter right before Carl died, he wrote a letter to Bill Wilson in response to a letter that Bill wrote to him thanking him for his contribution to AA in the case of Roland Hazard, and how that pieces of that puzzle, that information he gave Roland, was part of the Alcoholics Anonymous coming about. And Carl wrote back to Bill, and he said something. It's an amazing letter. If you ever get a chance to read it, there's so much amazing stuff in that letter. But the one thing that hit me the most is Carl said to Bill that he'd always believed from working with alcoholics of Roland's type, but he wouldn't tell Roland this, that the alcoholic's thirst for alcohol wasn't really a thirst for alcohol. He said he believed it was a low-level thirst of his being for unity, for connectedness, or as expressed in religious or medieval terms, a union with God. I guess I drank because I missed God and didn't know that. But there was a vacancy right in the center of who I am, and I tried to fill it with a lot of things. And alcohol came the closest for a number of years. And then years after it turned on me, I still drink and hoping against hope that I'll drink like I drank when I was 18 years old one more time. Alcoholism is a progressive disease. What that means is as the years go on, my ability to get the magic diminishes and the problems increase. And it's almost, you know what it's like? It's like when, in the early days when I would go out to party with my friends, it was like spinning a roulette wheel, a party wheel. And on that wheel you'd have drag racing and dancing and getting laid and playing with bands and shooting pool and laughing and roughhousing with the guys. Once in a while, you'd have throwing up and a little allocation with the police. But for the most part, you'd spin that wheel. It's coming up, party, 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 party. And as the years progressed and the disease progressed within me, it's like some hideous force is screwing with the wheel and they're taking off some of the good stuff and they're putting up some awful stuff, like wet pants. I'll tell you something. Diaper rash is cute when you're 2 years old. It's not cute when you're 22 years old. Getting arrested and going to jail and getting so physically sick I feel like I'm going to die. And problems with jobs and inability to hold them and emotional problems and mental problems and relationship problems and blackouts. Oh, I'm a blackout drinker. Any blackout drinkers in here? Oh, Patty, oh, yeah, my people. It's hard going through life when other people know more about you than you do. I mean, that's just that's a rough deal, I'm telling you. And you know, if you're like me, nobody ever comes up to a guy like me the next day and says, oh, Bob, you were so helpful last night. You peed in our kitchen. You hit on my wife. You broke my lamp. You sideswiped my car. You passed out on my front lawn. I had a guy one time, I was hungover on my way to the liquor store. I was shaking. He came up to me to tell me that I'd told everybody the night before that I'd beat Bruce Lee in a karate match. Oh, my God. I just wanted to crawl under a rock somewhere. Oh. And there's always those people that just wait to tell you. It's like Christmas for them. They just can't. Oh, they just lights them up. Oh, some of them end up in Al-Anon. So I'm encouraged. My drinking's turned into caca as the years go on. And yet, isn't it funny, even in the bleak years, and the last few years were bleak, and the reason that I love the description in the big book, in A Vision for You, where it talks about the end. And it says we can't imagine life with it because it's turned on us and it's pathetic and it's awful. And that really was. Now at the end of my drinking, I'm not the guy that's playing sitting in with the bands. I'm not the guy that's laughing and talking to the girls. I'm the guy that holds up somewhere if I can. Drinks myself into oblivion. I'm the guy that drinks and feels sorry for himself. I'm the guy that goes on crying jags sometimes. I'm the guy that ends up in emergency rooms because in a panicked rage or just a fit, I'll put my fist through a plate glass window and now I'm bleeding all over the place. Or I don't bathe anymore because I don't care. I don't take care of myself because once the fun and the magic came out of partying, it felt like there's nothing to live for. And so I drank for oblivion. I drank the last couple years just to blot it out. Because every time I was conscious, I'm in the presence of the guy I hate the most, me. Because as the years went on, I started compromising every moral and value I ever had. I hurt every person that ever loved me. It seemed like my parents, who would have done anything for me, for loving me, I seemed to punish them for it. And my little sister, who I was at one time was her hero, I punished her for her love. And any woman that tried to love me seemed... Nobody came away from me feeling good about Bob. Nobody. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 78, and I started getting into the steps. And I had when I got to my 8-step list, I'll tell you, I had a long list of people I hurt. But on the square, there was not one name on that long list of people I really hurt a lot that I ever set out to hurt intentionally. And I just don't get what I'm doing to these people. I can't see past myself and my own drivenness. I can't see past my own obsessive need to try to fix myself, to try to jumpstart that party, to make me better. I can't see past that, so I don't even get a clue what I'm doing to you. I never once even put myself in your shoes to even speculate. I never got it. I couldn't see past me. I had too much of me between me and life, and me and you, and me and God, and me and everything. One of the great descriptions of Alcoholics Anonymous was coined in 1946 by a non-alcoholic. And he was a doctor, Bill Baer, and Bill was asked to investigate us. Because in the early 40s, Alcoholics Anonymous was getting a lot of notoriety. We just had the Jack Alexander article in Liberty and a whole bunch of stuff. And we were up for the Lasker Award. It didn't come for a few years, but we were on the radar for it. People were wondering what AA was all about. So this Dr. Baer went to a few meetings, looked at our book, and he made a report to the AMA about what he thought we were. And a little portion of it is repeated and reprinted in the back of the big book in a little obscure section, very few people ever read, called The Medical View of Alcoholism. And I'll tell you something, I think Dr. Baer nailed us. And if you're new and you think this is a self-help program, I'm telling you, it's not. Matter of fact, it's almost the opposite. And Dr. Baer said that Alcoholics Anonymous, he says, we're not crusaders. And that's true for the most part, even though there is a little phase some of us go through. But then we usually get out of that, if you don't get out of that phase, you don't stay sober usually. We're not crusaders, and that's true. He says there, and we're not a temperance society, and that's true. Probably in this room, there's people that work in bars or restaurants. We're not fighting alcohol. What he says, and this is where he really nails this, he says that they are people, these AAs are people who know that they must not drink. And that knowledge, for some of us, almost killed us in its acquisition. Some of us almost died before we got that. And then he really nails me. He says, so they throw themselves into helping others with similar problems. And in that atmosphere, the alcoholic will often overcome his excessive concentration upon himself. I read that the first time and I thought, oh my God, Dr. Baer, is it that obvious? I think I was sober several years before I got that everything I do in AA is so I can overcome my excessive concentration upon myself. That when I stop, when it says in the big book that selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of the trouble, they're not kidding. I stop drinking, I just get me and my emotions and my judgments and my me just kind of on me like that creature and alien that attaches itself to your face. How you doing, Bob? Well, I'm hanging in there. And it feels like depression to me, but it's not. It's the depression. It's not clinical depression, it's spiritual depression. My spirit is smothered with me. It's the depression of the obsessively, overly self-involved. And I can't get free. And every time, and I relapsed for 7.5 years, I can't tell you how many times I got sober and drank again. It was many times. And when I look back, I can remember incidences of abstinence right before I'm about to drink again. And I'm going at the first drink with an anticipation of freedom. Because I've been up in here, locked up now for 7 or 8 or 10 or 11 months, feeling like I'm doing time, not drinking. And man, there's a part of me just wants to bust out. And the only thing in my whole life that I've ever found that when I'm locked up in my head in the bondage of self that ever freed me like that was at one time 5 shots of tequila would free me from the bondage of self. But what I can't see is the truth. And the truth is that alcohol has stopped doing that for me. I've entered into the bleak years. Now, and isn't it funny, a guy like me, where the last 10 times I went out to party, it's no fun. It's pathetic. It's self-pitying. It's awful. And yet, I'll be sober for 10 months or 8 months or 7 months on my way to get drunk, believing, deluded into thinking that I'm gonna get the effect from alcohol that I got when I was 18 years old again. In spite of overwhelming experience and evidence that that is dead. That horse is dead. But yet, I don't want it to be dead. And the book talks about this self-delusion, which is, if you don't know what that is, it's like a psychotic wishful thinking. It's all the evidence is the party's over, but man, I ain't no good without the party. And I don't want the party to be over. And I don't want it to be over so badly that I will start imagining that it's not, even though it is. It's that psychotic, wishful thinking. Until I believe it. Until I'm on my way to drink, convinced that I'm gonna cut it up. It's going to be great. It's going to be like it was when I was 18 years old. My second to last run, I was in a halfway house, and I'd been sober a while for me. I mean, a long time. I don't know. It wasn't a year. It was maybe 9 months, maybe 10 months, maybe 11. I don't know, but I know it was less than a year, which is a terribly long time to live dry with untreated alcoholism if you're an alcoholic like me. It's a terrible long time to have to be feeling that loneliness and separation like you don't fit anywhere. Of the boredom and the vacancy and the depression and the restless, the irritable, the discontent. I remember one time I went to this old timer and I was so at the end of my rope and I just said, "What do you guys do? What do you do for fun in AA?" And he says, "Oh, we go to a lot of meetings." I thought, "Oh, you got anything else?" He said, "Oh, twice a year we got an AA dance." You ever been to an AA dance with untreated alcoholism? Oh my God, you remember why I used to drink quick. I mean, oh, it's horrible. It's like, oh, it's all of them, and then there's me. Oh, it's terrible. The book says we'll know a loneliness such as few do. Man. So to me, AA had good news and bad news. The good news that if I went to thousands of these stupid meetings, I'll stay sober the rest of my life. And the bad news, I'm going to live a long time. And I'm the guy that talks about vision for you. I can't imagine life with it, without it. And then the book says someday he will be unable to imagine life with it or without it. And then guys like me get to the jumping off place. And we either take our own lives or we come to Alcoholics Anonymous again. And I'm at this halfway house and I'm hanging on by my fingernails. And I know I don't want to drink because I'm always in trouble anymore. And I'm homeless. I'm in this halfway house because it's winter. I know some people go to Bermuda. I go to treatment. I mean, I'm a homeless guy. I'm living on the streets. I know what it's like to just about freeze to death walking the streets when it's 4 degrees outside and you can't even sit down. So I'm in this place and I'm hanging on. It's getting to be, I think it was like beginning of March. It's not too bad out anymore. It's starting to be a little springtime coming at me, about a month away or so. And I can't take it anymore. And I plan this run. I plan on going to party with this guy that I was in detox with, and I found out he was, I called him, he was back to drinking. I kind of suspected he was. And I'm going to come down, and he told me to get a weekend pass. I can stay in his trailer. I can party with him all weekend. He told me about this rock and roll bar he found out. He knows about, and he had some Thai stick, and he said the girls down there are great in the bands, and man, I'm up to here with this sober thing. I need some fun. I don't want to hurt nobody. I don't want to burn my life to the ground. I've just got to have a little fun. I mean, I have been a really good sport up to now. Because I'm a victim of the delusion. The illusion it talks about in chapter 3 that someday, some way, I'll control and enjoy my drinking. I think I can still enjoy it like I did when I was 18 years old and control it enough to keep the damage down to something reasonable. That's the delusion. And I went to meet this guy, and I'll never forget it. The best part of that run, like the last 8 or 10 I was on, was the hour or so before it started. And I'm in this bar, and I'm ordering these double shots, 100 proof whiskey, beer backs, because when you only got a weekend, you got to get downtown now. I mean, just, and I want to jumpstart the party. I want to get that thing going on where I can come out and play. There's some girls I want to dance with. I want to shoot some pool. I want to have some laughs, for God's sakes. Aren't I entitled to that? And I'm throwing those double shots down, and it ain't jump-starting. Only thing that's jump-started in me is the phenomenon of craving. And I'm sitting there sinking into self-pity as I'm watching the people in the bar laugh and have a good time and wondering, what's wrong with me? Because I could remember when I was all about that. And I couldn't get it back. And every once in a while, alcoholics get real lucky. And through the fog and the self-delusion, a window opens up and you can see the truth. And I could see the truth that this is it. This is the best it's ever going to get. It's like that scene in that movie, As Good As It Gets, where Jack Nicholson's walking through the waiting room of the psychiatrist's office, and everybody's depressed and they're doing badly. And he stops and he looks at everybody and he says, "What if this is as good as it gets?" And they all go, "Oh." That's exactly how I the window opened and I saw that this is it. That I'll never, I got it, that I can drink myself to death, but I will never get back to the way it was when I was 18 years old again. And that was a horrible, horrible, depressing realization. You know, they say the truth will set you free, but I'm telling you, it'll ruin your day first. Man. I never made it back Sunday night to the halfway house. I came to Monday morning in a county jail, facing 2 years in a state penitentiary for hit and run DUI and a stolen car. They gave me a phone call, and I hope I never forget that a guy like me that was once real popular, that had a family that would have done anything for me, my alcoholism took me to a place where there was no one to call. There was no one that would take my call. And I did that to me. And so I signed up to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the county jail. I'll be honest with you, I did not go for recovery or sobriety or any of that. By now, I'd given up on AA. Because I'd probably been in 200 meetings by now. I'd been in many institutions. I'd watched all the Father Martin movies. I'd done all that stuff. I'd been to the psychiatrists. Some of the greatest. The guy at Clayton, I loved his talk. My dad was so politically connected. He actually got me in therapy with Albert Ellis. He said, "Ship me up to New York to the Institute of Rational Emotive Therapy." I was in therapy with Ed Silverman, who studied under Fritz Perls. I mean, I went to some great psychologists. I really relate to Roland Hazard, that it never changed anything, really. And I remember one time going to a weekend deal where they wouldn't even let you sleep. They kept you awake until you just broke down and dealt with your feelings. I mean, I'm telling you, that weekend changed my life for 2 weeks. And then what happens to me is I'm always back to being me again. And that's not good, because back to being me again is the guy that's restless, irritable, discontent, the guy that has that suffers from the loneliness of the anxious apartness that Bill talks about in the 12 by 12, an inability to fit until the loneliness just eats my lunch. Back to being me is not good. Back to being me is back to being the guy who, in spite of everything, will always drink again. And I didn't know that I had alcoholism. I go to AA meetings and I'm convinced that I don't have, I'm not like you people. I knew that I had seeming evidence because I watched you guys for 7 years. And I watched you stopped drinking, you burnt your life to the ground with alcohol, but you stopped drinking and you were magnificent. You were wonderful. You were grateful for everything. You loved everybody. Your life just took off like a rocket. You had great relationships and success and all this stuff. I stopped drinking. I feel like I'm doing time. I mean, it's not, I'm not any of that. And I don't understand. So I'm in the county jail. I go to this AA meeting not for recovery. I'd given up on Alcoholics Anonymous. I went for cigarettes. And in the back of my mind, I knew that some of those people in AA had big homes and did very well financially. I might be able to kind of lead someone into putting their house up or helping me to get out on bail or something. You never know. You got to be thinking all the time when you're on those streets. I mean, you just got to be thinking. And I'm sitting and I'm waiting for the do-gooders from AA to show up. They always show up. You got to understand, I'm not an alcoholic. But for some strange reason, every time I start drinking, I end up where all the alcoholics are at. I don't know what that's about. But I'm sitting in the room waiting for the do-gooders from AA to come. And here they come. And leading the pack is a guy I know. I don't like, but I know him. His name's Woody. Woody used to bring meetings into one of the detoxes I was in. Woody brought meetings into the halfway house. Woody brought meetings into a treatment center I was in. Woody was one of those big book carrying, God loving, grateful for everything. Oh God, if you're sitting there with untreated alcoholism, he's just about more than you can take, really. I mean, he's awful. He's something that just annoys me. He's happy and sober at the same time, for God's sakes. And here he comes to rub his great life in my face, you know, like they always do. And here he comes. And I'm so ashamed of myself. I've always, every time I relapse, I'm properly ashamed of myself. And I go up to him and I apologize for letting him and all the people in AA down, as if I expected that Alcoholics Anonymous has gone into mourning because I drank again or something. I don't know. And I start trying to work him. You know, I'm trying to work him because I knew he had a big house and two nice cars and a great job. He was a boss at the steel mill, you know, and I'm working him. And I worked him around to him telling me that he's like to help me. Ah, yeah. So I explained it to him about how I needed him to put his house up. And the people in AA are hypocrites. They say they want to help you until you explain it to them. And then they don't want to go. And he don't want to. He wants to give me a big book. I don't want a big book. I want out of here. He wants to give me a big book. He wants to give me his phone number. He wants to help me with the steps. I don't want to do the steps. If I ever got my life together, I might do the steps. I might join a gym too. Who knows? But I need out of here right now. And he ain't gone, man. And I get angry at him. I just get that bluster. Go, I don't need your help. I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to beat this thing. I'm going to get in a good halfway house, not like that one that took advantage of me. I'm getting a good one. I'm going to get some of that government voc rehab money. I'm going to go to college. I might be a doctor or a lawyer. And he starts laughing. He's laughing. And he's shaking his head. And he says, who are you trying to kid? He said, you're not going to do any of that. You're not even going to stay sober. You're probably going to die of alcoholism, kid, because you haven't hit a bottom. You haven't surrendered. Now, I didn't say nothing to him because I don't like confrontation sober. But I'm telling you, I just went and sat in that meeting. Did you ever just sit there and just think at someone? I'm just thinking at him. Just thinking it. And I just grinding away in my head. And what I'm thinking is, how dare you say that to me? Where's the AA love? I don't need that negativity. I need positive reinforcement. Haven't hit a bottom. Woody, you don't know nothing about me with your Cadillac and your big house. I live on the streets like an animal. Nobody cares about me no more. I have nobody to turn to. I hate myself. I'm dying. Surrender. Surrender what? There's nothing left of me. A couple years ago, I had a motorcycle, I had a girlfriend, I had a job. I don't got nothing. I don't even have any self-respect. I loathe myself. Surrender what? And I didn't know. I didn't know. I know today. When I got sober, I heard a speaker named Chuck Chamberlain talk, and when I heard Chuck talk, I knew exactly what Woody was talking about. I knew exactly why I was in AA this time, and things were getting different. And there's only one thing you ever have to surrender, and it's not the drinking. It's not anything I imagined. The one thing I have to give up is my judgment. I fit the old adage of you can always tell an alcoholic, but you can't tell him much. Right? I can go on a run, an alcohol can burn my life to the ground, I'll end up in Alcoholics Anonymous, the first thing I get back is my opinion and my judgment. And I'm the I know guy again, right? I'm the guy. Yeah, I did listen to you politely, yeah, and then go do whatever I want to do. Right? And what Woody saw is the same thing I've seen on a regular basis for 28 years. I have never done less than 2 hospital and institution meetings per week throughout my whole sobriety. And every single week I see the exact same thing that Woody saw. What Woody saw was a man who was dying, who had burned his life to the ground and continued to do that, and he's going to die. And yet, in spite of that, insisting on being at the wheel of his own ship. Insisting on it. Because I'm not sponsorable. I'm the only person I'm listening to is me. If you say something that happens to agree with what I want to do anyway, you're brilliant. And if you don't, I'm going to do what I want to do. So I'm unteachable. I'm unsponsorable. I'm so full of me that there's no room for you. And you can't. I can't connect with you. I can't stop judging my own life and what I need and what's wrong with you and what's wrong with what you're telling me. I can't shut that down. And consequently, if you're like that, it's pretty hard to connect with anybody in AA. Because you can't stop picking them, what they're saying apart. And I went before a judge who sentenced me to 2 years in a state penitentiary, and then he was very kind to me. The PO department had found one place left that would take me. I'd been in every place, settled anywhere. It's not that I'm irritable. When I quit drinking, I just realize what's wrong with everybody. And I just need to tell them. And it makes abstinence a lonely business. And so I drink again. And after I hung in there as long as I could, and I picked up a drink, and phenomenon of craving kicked in, of course. And I went on my last run. I didn't know it was my last run. And it was pathetic and it was awful and depressing. And I went to a bridge on the north side of Pittsburgh with a bottle of Richard's Wild Irish Rose. And I'm on this bridge because I just want to make this stop. I ain't doing this no more. Because I'm not a suicidal guy, but you put me in a trap I can't spring where drinking is awful. And not drinking is awful. Suicide can start looking like a good deal to a guy like me. Little did I know that that's the place it refers to in the big book where it says we get to that place where there's nothing left. Then we get to the place where we can't imagine life with it or without it. We'll be at the jumping off place. We'll wish for the end. And that's where I am. I'm on this bridge trying to take my own life, but I'm a coward. And I couldn't jump. And at the last second when it's time to pull the plug, I just broke down and started sobbing and wrecked my hand, banging it on this piece of metal, cursing myself for being such a weakling. And little did I know that I was about to walk into the only good life I've ever had. I didn't know that. I thought my life was over. I ended up off that drunk in a hospital in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I was so I've had worse drunks. I've had more horrific drunks. But this was the one that broke my spirit. And I was completely demoralized. And I was hopeless. And it was like all my get up and go had got up and went. And I just remember going to those meetings and I just sitting there. And I ain't fighting nobody no more. I ain't trying to figure the people out. I'm just sitting there in this hopeless condition of mind and body. And the message of Alcoholics Anonymous washed over me. And I guess what had happened is I had just enough of me beaten out of me to finally hear you. And I remember sitting there and my first sponsor and members of what was to be my first home group brought meetings in there. I didn't know or suspect that the people you meet in an institution, the AA members that come in there, I didn't know that that's the cream of the crop here. Those are the selfless people that stay in the trenches in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those are the members that believe that this is their primary purpose, that have walked away from themselves being their primary purpose. And they serve this ethic. And I was introduced to them, and I remember sitting in the meetings, and as they shared, something happened to me that had never happened to me before. I sat there and I found myself nodding my head as they talked about themselves and thinking to myself, oh my God, I'm like that. I felt like that. I thought like that. I drank like that. I failed like that. I started to connect with these people. And out of that came a lot of hope. Because the one guy that was to be my sponsor, I listened to his story. He was a homeless guy that was trying to kill himself, but he didn't have enough money for bullets because every time he'd get almost enough money for a box of bullets, it was all about the same price as a bottle of vodka. And that is a bad dilemma. And he'd been a homeless guy, and he drove a brand new Cadillac, and he lived up on a hill with tennis courts in his house. I mean, I never even heard of anything like that. I'm a bum. How do you get from there to there? And more important than that, he had that thing. He laughed a lot. He looked more alive and more vital than I felt for... the only time I ever was like that was when I was about 18 years old and I had about a pint of whiskey in me. And I thought, man, I want what this guy's got. And I joined them. And I guess I left the group that I was in AA, a group I'd been in for 7.5 years, a group that's dying of alcoholism. And I moved into the other group. And there's two groups here. Don't let anybody kid you. There's two groups here. I got 5 or 6 big boxes of pictures of AA events going all the way back to 1978. And I could show you hundreds of nice men and women that are now died of alcoholism. Because they were in the other group, the group I was in for 7.5 years. And the line between the two groups is, it's talked about every meeting. It's read at every single meeting. It says, those who do not recover, the group I used to be in, are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. I was part of that group. Not because I'm stupid or I just don't get it. I can't hear anything you're talking about. I hear you talk about the steps, but have you ever looked at the steps when you're suffering from depression and untreated alcoholism? They don't match your personal problems. I don't know, and I don't know anybody that ever walked into AA being hopeless and miserable and looked up at the steps and went, oh yeah, that'll work. I've never met anybody like that. Most of us come to the table on the steps because we're beaten half to death, and it's either the bottle or the pistol. I mean, we don't have much choice. And that's what happened to me, I guess. I came to Alcoholics, and after trying to kill myself, I came here. And I started throwing myself at doing everything you guys did. And my life started to change. My first sponsor, I was such a high maintenance sponsee for a while. Oh man. I remember the first time I got a sponsee, how he lit up because he knew from this, you know, it was the beginning of me being not so high maintenance anymore, right? And I'm the same way. When I'm sponsoring a guy and all of a sudden he's starting to sponsor people, I go, whew, because he's going to be fine. Because if you don't start giving something away here, you're in trouble. I understand what Bill said in his story, what he said, unless the alcoholic will expand his spiritual life through self-sacrifice and work, constant work with others, he'll never survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. Certain means you're on a pink cloud. They're coming, man, I'm telling you, they're coming. And the only thing that saved my life is that I bought a commitment to try to help others when I was new. And I started going to hospitals and institutions, and I started going on 12-step calls. I started looking for the new guys in the group and just the meetings that were newer than I had. Just sticking my hand out. I don't have anything to give away, really, except to try to make them feel welcome and listen to them. And I started to connect with some of these people. And I suffered still until I was over 4 years sober with a lot of depression because I was real self-involved. And I don't know what's wrong with me. I get up in the morning, I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, and 10 minutes later, I'm in my head full of anxiety planning the whole day. Right? Because what I've done, it says in our book on the bottom of 62, in the top of, or on the bottom of 60 in the top of 61, is that this decision in step 3, it's a vital and crucial step, but it's going to have little permanent effect unless followed at once by a strenuous effort to be rid of the things that are blocking me. You see, I can't carry out the decision in step 3. I can't. And not from a lack of want to. I am blocked. Because what I'm doing essentially is I'm giving God my life, but I've retained and my will, which is my judgment machine. And if you retain your judgment and your perception of your life and you try to give God your life, it's like saying, God, here's my life, but there's a list coming of how it better go. And you know what depression is? That's when God stops doing your will. Right? And I'm full of the anxiety of not getting my way and the depression when I don't get my way. And I'm still full of me and I'm cut off from you. And I'm judging my way right out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the one thing that saved my life was 12-step work. When it says in working with others that nothing so much ensures immunity like intensive work with other alcoholics, I'd be a dead man. I wouldn't be here if I hadn't have bought that principle. And I threw myself at that because I didn't know what else to do. And partly because I also wanted the approval of the old-timers who were really into service. They weren't into the book very much back in those days. They were really into helping other drunks. And I'll tell you two quick little stories and I'll shut her down. I'm sober about a year and a half. I'm going to 15 or 20 meetings a week. I'm a GSR. I'm an intergroup rep. I'm on two roundup committees. I go on 12-step calls. I have institution commitments every week. It's like I'm trying to outrun my alcoholism, right? By all this activity. But I haven't worked the steps yet. And so I still suffer from bouts of depression and feelings of not fitting. And I'm real up. I get uptight judging people and all that stuff. And I'm coming home one night. I'd been to two meetings that day. I'd prayed. And I talk to my sponsor, and I'm sitting on the sofa, and I'm sinking into a deep, deep depression. It's that kind of depression where you just get yourself and your life and your future and your past and your emotions kind of right on you. And it seems like the more, if you're like me, the more I focus on them, the bigger they get. And I'm sitting on this sofa, and I'm sinking into the abyss, and it's bad. It's so bad I feel like I weigh 1,000 pounds. And I didn't know what to do, and I asked God for help. I said, please help me. And I looked at the clock, and it was almost 10 o'clock at night, and there's a meeting going on not too far away up on the strip at this chapel called the Between the Shows group of Alcoholics Anonymous, this chapel called Duffy's. And I don't know how, I got myself off that sofa somehow. Shuffled out to my car like a mope. Got in that car, drove to that meeting, parked right in front of the door to the chapel. There was a space there underneath the billboard on the strip, I guess where the pigeons hang out, so they'll probably could decorate my car during the meeting, fit my mood, I guess. I don't know. And I go in the meeting, and I'm sitting in the back of the room, but I can't hear nothing. Because I'm so in here trying to figure out my life. And I'm a victim of another delusion it talks about in the big book in chapter 5. The delusion that I can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world if I only manage well. Which sometimes translates that I'm going to think myself out of this abyss. If you've ever tried to think yourself out of a depression, it's like getting a shovel. You just go deeper and deeper. And the more I ponder my life, the bleaker it looks. I've never got me right here and came away joyous. I mean, I've never done that. It just looks, the job is terrible and I'm always going to be alone. And it's horrible. And I'm sitting in the meeting and the meeting's actually making me worse because the subject is gratitude. And oh, man. There's a guy sitting across from me that's coming off a drunk and he's in really bad shape, really bad shape. He can't sit still. He's grabbing himself and he's rocking back and forth like he wants to jump out of his skin. And he can't even sit still very long. And then he gets up and he's pacing back and forth behind me like a caged animal. And the bathroom's right there, and then you can hear him go in there a couple times, and he's in there dry heaving. And I'm trying to figure out the problems in my life, and this guy's annoying the crap out of me. I mean, and the meeting's over. I've heard nothing. I'm doing actually worse. And I stay after to help Charlie, who's the secretary, set the chairs up and clean the trash out for the chapel at the end of the meeting. Charlie and I are the last two guys to leave, and Charlie's on his way to work. He works one of the graveyard ships in one of those casinos up on the strip, and we're standing on the front of the chapel, and he's locking up, and I look over, and the guy that was in the meeting, coming off the drunk, is laying in front of my car in a fetal position. Now, I will have to step over him to go home and really figure out my life in a little more depth. Which, I am embarrassed to tell you, I might have done that, except that Charlie's there. And Charlie's got a big mouth, and if I don't help this guy, he's going to tell everybody in A what a lousy member I am. And Charlie's saying, you're going to help this guy, and I'm looking at this guy, and I'm looking at Charlie, and I'm thinking, oh, man. And I go over to the guy, and he's peed his pants, and he smells, and he's pathetic, and he has no medical insurance, and they closed down the starting point, and they hadn't opened West Care yet, and there was a period of time in Las Vegas that if you were in danger of DTs or convulsions and you needed to be detoxed and you don't have medical insurance or money, you were in trouble. What we used to do sometimes is we'd sit with a guy, two guys on a shift, give him an ounce of vodka and orange juice about every hour just to keep him from going over the edge. But I couldn't do that. It's like almost midnight. There was one other thing we could do in those days, and I'd done it several times on 12-step calls, and it was just awful, is you could take a guy down to the county hospital, and because they got some government money, they were forced to take a certain number of indigent patients, but they treated you like a redhead stepchild. They had this attitude like they would rather treat real sick people rather than these self-induced guys, and they'd let you wait there sometimes with a guy for 4, 5, 6 hours. And I got the guy in my car, and I'm driving down to the county hospital, the emergency room, and I know what's coming. I'm going to be there all night. And I'm thinking to myself, isn't it enough that my life is crap? I got to do this too. Doesn't anybody else step up to the plate in AA except me? I'm going to be tired. I'll have a bad attitude for work in the morning, probably lose that job, and it's a lousy job anyway. I don't say any of that to the guy. I'm just driving. I get down there. We go in the emergency room, sign up on the sheet. We're sitting in the waiting room, and I'm giving him cigarettes, and we're talking. You could smoke. That's hard to believe, isn't it? You could smoke in a hospital waiting room in those days. And I'm going to the vending machine. I'm getting these little cans of orange juice. Sometimes in those days, we'd give guys orange juice and honey. But there's no honey, but there's sugar from the coffee deal. So I'm putting a little sugar in there and shaking up, giving it to him. He starts to tell me about himself. And he starts to tell me about the shame and the guilt and the remorse he feels for the things he did to the people who loved him. And he says, I can't even drink it away anymore. And he tells me that for some time he's been wishing he could kill himself, and he's been thinking about killing himself, and he just doesn't seem to have the courage to do it and make it stop. And then he really hooks me. He says to me, I don't know why you're wasting time with me. I'm not like you people in AA. You see, I always drink again. and this guy is telling me about me. And in the wee hours of the morning, I fell in love with this guy. And I don't know why. He can't do nothing for me. He can't get me a better job. This idiot's probably not even going to stay sober a year and give me some kind of credit for something. This guy has nothing he can do for me. Except that he suffers from alcoholism exactly like I suffered from it. And I fell in love with him. It was years later in sponsoring guys that I realized what had happened. I fell in love with the me that is in him, a me that I could never, ever love directly. And I used to try. I had a therapist that was big on, you got to love yourself. She used to tell me, you got to love yourself. She gave me positive affirmations one time. She told me, every morning you stand, you go to the halfway house in the bathroom and look in the mirror and say over and over again, God loves me, God forgives me, God accepts me. I love me, I forgive me, I accept me. God loves me. God forgives me. God accepts me. I love me. My God, what a bunch of crap this is. I could have stood in front of that mirror and said that till the planet blew up, and it would not have changed the way I felt about myself one bit. But as I started to care about you and make the amends and do all that stuff, man, my whole deal with me. Not only did my whole deal with God change and my whole deal with you change, my whole deal with me changed. I don't feel about myself the way I used to feel about myself. I don't feel about you and this planet the way I used to feel about you and this world. And I really don't feel about God the way I used to. I was terrified of God. And that happened through the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they checked that guy in the wee hours of the morning, and I'm driving home and the sun's coming up and I'm crying. And I'm not crying because I'm depressed. I'm crying because I don't know in my whole life I ever felt more plugged in, more connected, more useful, more right about my whole life at that moment. All the pieces kind of fit together and I got something. I got that this is why I'm alive. And I don't know that I ever felt better in my life. A friend of mine, a guy that I sponsor, he calls that. He says, that's the good dope. And I started to buy that as my primary purpose. And it saved my life. And it enhances and vitalizes my spirit to this day. But I also learned how to clean house here and to get the aspects of self that keep me in the driver's seat out of the way so I can better serve you and serve the one who has all power. Because as an alcoholic, I am absolutely convinced that all alcoholics will serve something. Most of us serve ourselves. And you have a choice of either serving yourself, and it's not like you haven't tried that, or serving an ethic and a set of principles and a purpose and a power greater than yourself. And if you do that, your life will change. And if you don't, it probably won't. 17 years ago, I guess, I was up in Northern California at an AA function, and this guy took me to show me around, and he took me to this place where they had these trees. This was up near the Oregon border. They had these trees. I'd never seen anything like it. They were, 250, 300 feet high. Some of these trees were 25, 30 feet in diameter. I'm walking around this forest. It was amazing. It was like Jurassic Park. I felt small. There was a presence there in that forest. It was really, you could feel it. Like it had a life of its own. It was amazing. And the guy says, come with me. And we go get in his truck and we're driving. He wants to show me some more stuff. And we're driving by these meadows and fields. And the guy says to me, he says, you see, did you notice that you won't see one of those 250-foot trees all by themselves growing out in the middle of a field? I said, yeah. He says, you know why that is? I said, no, why is that? He said, well, it is their nature to aspire to grow to such magnificent heights that alone they will outgrow their roots capacity to support them, and they'll literally topple over on their own aspired magnificence. He said, what must happen is that they must grow up in community, and literally they will intertwine their root system to a net below the floor of the forest and literally support and hold each other up, and that allows them to grow into their nature. And when he said that, I've thought about this a million times, I guess. I thought, isn't that what has happened to me here? I came here a loner. I had one problem with Alcoholics Anonymous, really, that it was full of people. And I don't like people. But I came here beaten down by this disease, and I started to intertwine the very foundation of my life with yours by getting a sponsor and a peer group and sponsoring guys. And you have allowed me to grow into my nature. You see, this nature that I've had, this thirst, this hunger, this yearning for more, almost killed me prior to getting to you. And in your hands, it's become a magnificent thing. I have a great, magnificent life today. And it's not my fault. Really and truly, it's not my fault. I come and I serve a very big God, a very generous God that I've been wrong about. I serve a fellowship and a set of principles that I had been wrong about. I live on a planet and in a world that I had been wrong about. And I'm so glad that I was wrong. Thank you for my life.